Monsieur le Président, Monsieur le Directeur Général, c'est pour moi un très grand plaisir d'être ici à Montréal. I had a thought that I might speak to you this afternoon about my new book, The End of Normal. But I fell under the misimpression yesterday that the audience I spoke to then would overlap with this one. Turns out it's not so much. And so I decided that I would focus my remarks on a topic on which I've been working for 20 years and which I think has a certain bearing on your position as responsible investors. However, before I do that, my publisher, Simon & Schuster, would not forgive me if I didn't wave a copy of The End of Normal in front of you and give you the information that Time Magazine just named it one of the big business books of the fall. But you will not hear more about what's in it from me this evening. Inequality, I venture to say, is one of the most contentious issues in our politics and in our larger social discourse at the moment. There's also, for an economist, which I still sometimes admit to being, is one of the most subtle and one of the most confused questions that we encounter. And so I do want to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to make an attempt to organize my thinking on this topic. At the most basic level, inequality is an inescapable fact of economic life. No society, and certainly no economic system, has ever functioned without it. Moreover, dynamic societies often tend to have more. Joseph Schumpeter recognized and emphasized this many years ago, that the existence in an economic setting of a small number of very large prizes motivates many people to go after them, stimulates great efforts, as most of the players in the game overestimate their chances of winning. And the same principle was in the mind, I think, of Deng Xiaoping in China at the end of the 1970s, at the dawn of the reform period, the start of the rise of modern China, when he said that in a poor country, a few must get rich first and the rest will follow. The rise of China as a principal player on the world stage and the rise of inequality inside China, which in my work on the subject dates really from roughly 1989, maybe 1993, through the early 2000s, they go hand in hand. One of the interesting things, by the way, that the work that we've been doing very recently tends to suggest is that the rise of inequality in China peaked around 2002, 2003. And that after 2008, it has begun to decline, both because the process of development has spread out over much more of the territory, and because certain of the big winners, sectors, real estate, finance, utilities, suffered a big blow in the global crisis of 2008. I mention that because no one else has found it yet, and so I want you to know that when you do hear of other researchers finding this result, that you got it from me first. Still, despite this inescapable connection between inequality and a desirable dynamism, there's something about it that troubles us. Perhaps we absorb the work of John Rawls and we ask ourselves, would we have chosen the pattern of outcomes we observe if we were unaware of our own place in that pattern? We were behind the famous veil of ignorance. Or perhaps a bit more adventurously, we've read Thorstein Veblen on the leisure class. I have to say, I'm looking out here at a group of card-carrying members of Veblen's leisure class, at least latter-day leisure class, so nice to be talking to you. I am sure you are all familiar with the modern practices, forms of conspicuous consumption, conspicuous leisure, conspicuous waste, the decorative role of women and other chattel, and that may be a little bit 19th century, the subservience of dogs as against the independence of cats. As one of my daughters put it, dogs have owners, but cats have staff. The predatory disposition of the higher barbarians, that's you, or perhaps that's your irresponsible competitors. Veblen particularly noted the appalling dilemma faced by the academic, who is, that's me, of course, forced by the canons of reputable conduct to pretend to higher standards of dress, decorum, and depraved consumption than he or she can really afford. So in addition to having to put on a show, you have to do it well beyond your means. That's the professor's problem and the reason why there are relatively few of the professorate who actually managed to live in Manhattan. These tensions exist between the necessity of inequality and our disapprobation of it. Schumpeter and Veblen's epic arguments both ring true. And yet, for many years, particularly following the Second World War, for most of my childhood and education, in the United States and even elsewhere in the world, the tensions were kept at bay. They were kept at bay by a combination of factors, which we came to consider normal, which are now and have for some time been weakening considerably. Factors that include a steady and to be expected rate of economic growth, the tide that lifts all boats, countervailing power, a phrase introduced by my father in a book called American Capitalism in 1952, the predominance of large, stable industrial corporations, with very stable earning structures and mostly salaried employees, the spread of social welfare programs and social insurance schemes, the decline of peasant farming and the ubiquity of middle class urban and suburban environments. This was the era of my father, a noted Canadian named John Kenneth Galbraith, who observed in his book, The Affluent Society in 1958, that among economists and also in the larger society, the problem of inequality had all but dropped from view. Surprising observation considering that the 1930s were just a very short period before. But it was true. And it was still true as late as, say, 1974, 75, when I reached graduate school. And my professors at the time would casually observe that to study inequality was about as interesting as watching the grass grow. But then, of course, things began to change. And by the mid-1980s, even some economists had noticed that this was the case. Books began to appear, the Great U-Turn, that called attention to the consequences of economic crisis and deindustrialization for the middle class and the general structure of the society as high-end blue-collar jobs began to fade. The question of what was left began to show a profile of polarization that was not there before. But what caught my eye and drew me into the subject in the mid-1990s for the first time, I've been working on it on and off essentially ever since, was the peculiar reaction of the economics profession to this developing body of fact. Neither Veblen's scorn nor Schumpeter's defiant acceptance or championing of the phenomenon was revived. What economists did instead was to take the view that rising inequality was a kind of bloodless process, a natural phenomenon driven from outside the economic system, not endemic to it. And both Schumpeter and Veblen had seen it as being essentially an integral thing. But coming from outside, being created by the peculiar and hard to explain character of technological change that we were going under, there's a phrase that you may have heard, skill-biased technological change, or by globalization and the rise of international trade and the increasing competition of high-wage workers with their lower-wage counterparts in the developing world. Most economists being people inclined to take two wrong ideas and average them together accepted that this was some combination of the two and spent their time quibbling over how much of one and how much of the other. The idea of a race between technology and education became another one of the phrases that gained a certain amount of acceptance in the discussion of the question. And the effect was to admit the rise of inequality, but to place it in an antiseptic, anesthetized context, a result that would be considered inevitable as the side effect of otherwise good things, technology on the one hand, trade on the other, progress and globalization. Dr. Pangloss would have been very pleased. The difficulty, and here is where I began to work on the question and the point at which, with an undue degree of optimism, I hoped I might be able to affect the debate, is that it turned out that these assertions were built on an extraordinarily feeble foundation of pseudo-fact. Something which I labored to expose as far back as a book called Created Unequal in 1998, a book for which I began to develop extensive new measures of the course of inequality and pick out exactly when things happened and to try to work out what the driving forces were. And it clearly wasn't technology, it wasn't trade, it was the great recessions of the early Reagan period, the rise of unemployment, and the collapse of the manufacturing, of the high-end manufacturing base. And my exercise to attempt to call this all to the attention of the economics profession validated an old saw about economics, which states that if the facts come into conflict with the theory, it's so much the worse for the facts. But what my facts showed was that so far as the structures of pay are concerned, equality and economic performance tend to go hand in hand. That is to say, good economic performance, periods of high employment, tend to result in more equal structures of pay, and bad ones, periods of recession and depression, tend to result in much more unequal structures of pay, and also worse workplace conditions and lots of other things. And I raise this gets to this part of my title that has to deal with the question of implications for responsible investment. It seems to me that when you think about it, and here we're just talking about the conditions affecting working people, and I'll come to larger issues in a few minutes, there are two very straightforward reasons why this would be the case. One is that high inequality induces migration and search for jobs. It's one of the oldest stories. The peasant farmers leave the countryside to go to the factory towns because the pay is much better, but there are always far more migrant rural laborers than there are high-end factory jobs. Aspiring actors and actresses go to LA and New York for exactly the same reason, and there are never enough jobs for them. And while they're looking and while they're waiting, they're either employed in much lower wage jobs or they're unemployed. And so unemployment and inequality tend to go hand in hand for that reason. And there's a second reason that tends to play in this, and that is that when you have high minima in place and strong standards, and particularly true in smaller countries, these things encourage better business performance. That is to say, they tend to favor those enterprises that can produce at higher levels, higher productivity, and also better performance in other respects, including safety and the environment. And they tend to squeeze out those enterprises that can't do this. This was something, an insight that was recognized in Scandinavia as early as the 1930s, implemented certainly from the 1950s, and was a major reason why Sweden and other Scandinavian countries rose from being roughly average in European living standards to the very top of the world order. It is why the best businesses cooperate with reasonable regulatory standards on a whole host of dimensions, and why the worst ones put their resources into fighting those standards by lobbying against them or else flee to unregulated havens. I think this is clearly, and I dwell on it and pause over it because it clearly has implications for responsible investment, which apply as a general principle. When I first arrived in Texas many years ago, my colleague Ray Marshall, a labor secretary in the Carter administration, was describing how the application of standards to get cotton dust out of the air of the textile factories, mainly in the Carolinas, met with the cooperation of some firms, the resistance of others. When they applied the standards, it transformed the industry, made it much more productive, much more resistant to global competition, protected the jobs that were there, at the same time greatly improved the working conditions of the people in those plants. Brown lung, like black lung for coal miners, bisonosis was an extremely unpleasant disease. Long ago, as a boy in southern Ontario, this would be in the 1920s, my father, writing as a high school student, writing for the London, Ontario paper, a column, an anonymous column under the pseudonym of the Plowman, he wrote, among other things, of how the progressive farmers of that period welcomed the government men who could help them keep their herds free of tuberculosis, improving the health of the community and the competitiveness of the industry at the same time. Again, a homely example, but the principle is exactly the same. Another fact that emerged from my work challenged one of the core categorical divisions of economics, which is that between micro and macro. If you've ever taken an economic sequence, it has two of these things, one on one side of Christmas and the other on the other side. Christmas was invented so that two warring factions of economics would not have to come into direct conflict. Yeah. Inequality was assigned to the micro part. That is to say, it was assumed as a matter of prior edict that inequality arose from the interaction of supply and demand in lots of little markets. But what the evidence persuaded me of, what I think I was able to show, is that worldwide, as one collected more and better information, you could see that there are common regional, continental, and even global patterns in the movement of inequality. The most conspicuous of these being that over the period from 1980 to 2000, inequality rose almost everywhere, not all at the same time, but in a series of waves, beginning in Latin America, parts of Africa with the great debt crisis in 1980-81, moving on through Central Europe and Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union at the end of the 1980s when those regimes collapsed, and eventually reaching Asia just before the Asian crisis in the 1990s. This was the era, of course, of debt crises, unstable financial relations, and political upheaval. And that, I suggest, is a second finding with a certain implication for the practice of responsible investment. That is to say, that if one allows finance in its headquarter countries, including ours, to exert an uncontrolled influence, an unregulated influence over the world, it can wreak an enormous amount of damage on vulnerable people in vulnerable countries, a fact which was previously obscured by the absence of clearly comparable information on the movement of inequality in those countries. Now, those measures, what I've spoken about so far, were based upon measuring inequalities of pay, of earnings, working people's compensation. But of course, pay is not the whole story. If you want to take account of the inequality of income, a broader concept, you have to add in income from capital, which is, of course, an important feature of the richer countries, highly concentrated and very unstable. And when you do that, yet another exercise with the data, a third fact emerges. And that is, it's actually something you all know, that whereas before 1980, the sources of economic growth were balanced between the public and the private sectors, after 1980, they were almost entirely based upon waves of credit expansion. Start with the savings and loan expansion in the mid-1980s, but particularly the information technology boom that goes through the 1990s and peaks in 2000, and then the real estate finance boom and debacle that comes to a crashing climax beginning in 2007. Then in September, October of 2008. So you have this unstable process of credit creation and bust, and when you look at the pattern of income inequality, especially for the United States, where we have good tax data, tax-based data, to do this, it's extremely clear that the pattern of inequality is the same pattern. That it peaks in 2000, it peaks in 2007, and it peaks again, oh, roughly now. Right. That's, I think, a phenomenon that's closely related to something that's already been mentioned here this evening, which is the phenomenon of CEO compensation, clearly tied to capital asset valuations and separated from the cash flow of companies. Is this a good idea from the standpoint of responsible management of large corporations? Well, I think that question is one for you to contemplate. I think the answer is clear, and the issue before you is in part what to do about it. But there's a larger issue because the CEO pay is really a very small piece of the general movement of incomes into unstable speculative sectors. The whole phenomenon caused me to write a book 2 years ago that was called Inequality and Instability, and also to develop, after that book appeared, a notion which I think captures this particular aspect of the inequality issue, which is that economic inequality, properly measured, has a lot in common with blood pressure in the human animal. Now, it's obvious that blood pressure can be too low. Zero is for the morgue. Right? And there's a healthy range. And generally speaking, within that range, you'd like to be on the low side. But the key point is that when the measure starts going up, it may not be symptomatic. You may not feel sick. But that's a pretty good sign that you're heading for trouble. And I think in all those respects, these two metrics have a nice analogous property, one with the other. So what then should we do? I am, in many ways, quite conservative in my policy recommendations. I know there are people out there with extremely charming French accents who are saying that we should, on a continuing basis, evaluate everybody's capital wealth and then force you to liquidate a fraction of it and pay it to the government where it would disappear. I have never been able for the life of me to figure out why that would be a good idea, why something that simply depresses the price of capital assets would be a positive policy recommendation. And I suspect that your instincts would lead you to recoil from that. Not only your instincts, but perhaps also your professional sensibilities. But as I say, I'm a conservative on these matters. I like the institutions that were created in the 20th century. I think it was a mistake to erode them as we have been doing. And I think our whole societies, particularly in the context that I argue in my new book, where the growth, economic growth, is not going to be as easily achieved as it has been, that these institutions become more rather than less important. Well, what can you do? There are basically two approaches that you'll actually emerge from a study of the data. It's very interesting. One you find is the one you find in Eastern Europe and is a legacy of the systems that were built there under communism. And that is very, very compressed pay distributions, not much difference between market income and disposable income, not much redistribution. Flat pay structures. That's one way to do it. And the other way, which is closer to the Anglo-Saxon model, is to have very unequal pay structures and to redistribute quite a lot, right? So that you end up offsetting the inequality of market incomes. And I would argue that in their pure form, neither of these is really very sustainable. The first one has the problem that the societies are not competitive and resources, frankly, get misallocated. Doctors, too many doctors emigrate or drive taxi cabs if there's not a significant differential in the pay for different levels of preparation. Engineers, for example. Quite common in the post-communist world to observe that. In the Anglo-Saxon environment, the problem is that rich people don't like to have too much of their income taken away. So if you want to have enough resources to support the whole population, you have to be assured that rich people don't have too much to begin with. Otherwise, they spend too much on lobbying just to get rid of the social welfare institutions. But that's what we observe. I'm not making, you know, something which an econometrician to figure out. You just have to have open eyes. What's the right approach? It's somewhere in between. And the results, I think, bear out that the best results come from systems which combine a moderate amount of pay and income compression before the fact, so that the distribution to labor and between labor and capital is not extraordinarily uneven to begin with a decent amount of redistribution, but really redistribution is social insurance, which is to say that you are shielded against the most adverse consequences of life that you cannot quite predict in advance. Everybody gets sick, but you're not going to know exactly when. Health insurance protects those people who happen to draw the short straw when they need it. That is a major force in providing a more stable and sustainable social environment. I would add to that something I like very much in the institutional structure of North America, which is the particular, actually owes to Teddy Roosevelt, the particular incentives we have for great fortunes, once accumulated in Schumpeter's mold, to be recycled as quickly as possible into foundations, universities, hospitals, churches, and spent down. There should be more recycling and more spending down under the impetus of an effectively administered estate and gift tax. I think this is a very good system. It prevents big accumulations from going stale, from being sequestered in art collections and wine cellars, and enables them to be used instead to employ the population, doing useful things, like sitting in my classrooms. I am, I have to say, a living beneficiary to an extraordinary degree of this system. The state of Texas runs on it, the University of Texas certainly does, and I like it very much. My father, testifying once before the Senate Finance Committee, once suggested that, similar vein, that professors should be given a brain depletion allowance. The chairman of the committee was an oil man, of course. All of this is, I think, modest stuff, and therefore I lay a claim to a degree of responsibility, and I think it's something for which people who are concerned with responsible outcomes can press. And there are particular elements to it that I think are particularly timely and important. In the United States, we should be raising the minimum wage. We should be raising it by quite a lot. That would have a dramatic effect on the low end of the workforce, reorganize the kinds of services that they are most accustomed to purchasing, increase the incomes of parents, allow kids to be in school rather than working. It would have a lot of very favorable social effects, and evidence is that it would have practically no effect on employment. We should be preserving and strengthening Social Security and health insurance, not undermining them in the name of balancing budgets, austerity, and these kinds of things. These institutions become more, not less important under the conditions that they are. We should be pressing to restore effective regulation in finance and in other sectors of the economy, pushing back against the ideology that the government has no role in the modern society. The reality, of course, is that without effective regulatory presence, the major institutions of modern economic life could not exist at all. And when those regulations are removed, those institutions, like overheated transmissions, have a tendency to explode, which is what we observed in the financial sector in the period that produced the great debacle of 2008-2009. And finally, strengthening the mechanisms that help us to recycle those big prizes as effectively and as quickly as we can and put them to work, educating children, caring for the sick, caring for the elderly, caring for the environment, improving the quality of life, building our cultural institutions, doing everything that we need, that we know needs to be done. All of these things, I think, give you a comprehensive approach to the problem of inequality without removing the core purpose that inequality serves in any free and capitalist economy. Thank you very much for your time.